70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of Global Korea. Throughout the year, we celebrate the 70th anniversary of KBS World Radio with the voices of our listeners from all over the world.
Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi
wabarakatuh. Hello, I'm Samar Said from Egypt. Congratulations to all of you for the 70 years of outstanding service. I found KBS World Radio's Arabic service in 2004 when I was 24 years old. Back then, the drama Winter Sonata was immensely popular in Egypt, and I stumbled upon the KBS World Radio website, which had a special section dedicated to the drama. The first program I tuned into was Hull Calling, and I remember being surprised at how fluent the Korean speaker's Arabic was. The most beautiful memory I have of the channel is my visit to Korea on the invitation of KBS. I met the Arabic service staff and Super Junior, my favorite K-pop band. My heart still flutters just thinking about that day. I didn't know much about Korean culture and its people before KBS World Radio, but it completely changed my perspective. I find myself wanting to visit Korea and see the places mentioned on the radio and experience what was introduced on the channel more and more. KBS 너무 사랑해.
KBS. 70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of Global Korea. KBS World Radio brings Korea to you wherever you are.
Hello, it's Wednesday the 29th of March, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. The National Security Advisor, Kim Sung-han, has resigned following media reports of a planning issue related to President Yoon Suk-yeol's state visit to the US next month. We'll have more in news briefing shortly. Coming up for our in-depth today, we have a special interview with the new head of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Seoul Office to discuss human rights in North Korea. And for Korea Book Club today, we look at a book by the daughter of the late famed writer Park Won-sa about the recollections of her mother in the family kitchen. Let's begin Korea 24. National Security Advisor Kim Sung-han has resigned. This follows media reports speculating that the top office had been looking to replace him over a planning issue related to President Yoon Suk-yeol's state visit to the US. For more on this story and other headlines from today, I'm joined by KBS World Radio news editor Daniel Che. Daniel, hello.
Hello there, Jang-woo.
So the resignation came after the top office recently replaced a presidential aide on foreign affairs as well and a presidential protocol secretary. So can you tell us more?
That's right. Focusing on Kim Sung-han, in a statement released to media on Wednesday, he said that he hopes controversy surrounding him would no longer burden the administration in running state affairs. Kim said when he was offered the position a year ago, he told the president he would return to school after restoring South Korea-U.S. alliance, improving Korea-Japan relations, and laying the groundwork for strengthening security cooperation between South Korea, the U.S., and Japan. Kim believes these conditions have been met to some extent, and he added preparations for Yoon's trip to the U.S. are well underway. His successor should be able to carry out work without any problems. There were media reports that in the process of coordinating the schedule and events for Yoon's planned visit to the U.S., there had been omitted reports to the president. According to Yonhap News, Yoon nominated Cho Tae-yong, ambassador to the United States, as Kim's successor.
Yeah, so with less than a month to go before that major summit with the U.S., this has raised eyebrows. While there are speculative reports about what the planning issue was, they have not been confirmed as of yet, so we will have to leave that story for today and turn to our other headlines now. Prime Minister Han Duck-soo said he will suggest President Yoon Suk-yeol veto a bill mandating government purchase of surplus rice. So what's the latest on this?
On Wednesday, Han presented the position in a statement to the nation, pointing out that the opposition-led bill will throw the local rice industry into a bigger crisis. The PM denounced a revision as a forcible bill that coerces the government to purchase all the excess rice. That the bill won't help farmers or aid development of agriculture, expressing regret over how the bill was passed unilaterally. Han also voiced concerns the bill will paralyze the nation, the markets of Bali rather, to control supply and demand. Last week, the National Assembly, dominated by the main opposition DP, passed a revision to the Grain Management Act. The law requires the government to purchase overabundant rice from local farms when production exceeds 3 to 5% of estimated consumption, or when the price drops more than 5 to 8% on year.
Yes, there are some voices of opposition from farming groups, but the president is expected to veto the bill for now. Meanwhile, let's turn now to continuing fallout from the recent summit between President Yoon and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. The main opposition Democratic Party has submitted a request for a parliamentary probe into the summit. Can you tell us more?
Well, during a Supreme Council meeting on Wednesday, DP floor leader Park Hong-gun said the party strongly condemns Japan's blatant distortion of history and malicious infringement of Korean sovereignty. He decried the approval by Japan's Education Ministry of textbooks denying the forced nature of wartime labor and repeating false claims to Tokyo less than 2 weeks after the summit. Park said the president's humiliating diplomacy with Tokyo has come at the cost of insults suffered by the Korean people. He asked the government to respond with stern diplomatic measures that go as far as summoning the Japanese ambassador. Also called on President Yoon to directly protest to Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. As for the parliamentary probe, Park said the investigation will look into whether there were discussions on wartime sex slavery and Tokyo during Yoon's visit to Japan, and whether Tokyo requested lifting restrictions on Fukushima seafood imports. Park said the probe will also examine why South Korea took the first diplomatic steps with the withdrawal of its WTO complaint and initiated steps to normalize a military intel sharing pact and reinstate Japan on its trade whitelist.
Moving on, the chief of the Defense Security Command from the former Park Geun-hye administration, suspected of ordering a plan for martial law to be drafted, returned to South Korea after fleeing overseas more than 5 years ago. So can you tell us what happened?
Well, Cho Yeon-chun, former chief of the Defense Security Command, or DSC, arrived at Incheon International Airport at around 6:30 a.m. Wednesday from the United States. Cho is suspected of ordering a DSC task force to draw up a contingency plan to declare martial law and reported to then-Defense Minister Han Min-gu in February 2017, ahead of the Constitutional Court's ruling on Park's impeachment. The commander retired in September 2017 and left for the U.S. in December that same year, remaining beyond the reach of a joint military-civilian investigation team that had secured an arrest warrant for him in September 2018. The probe team suspended Cho's indictment 2 months later, as his whereabouts were unknown to the team after he left for the U.S. The ex-security chief then said last September that he would return home voluntarily and that actively cooperate with the investigation.
In other news, the government will put as much as 60 billion won towards travel and holiday subsidies in a bid to spur domestic consumption and breathe new life into the economy. This, of course, comes after the COVID-19 pandemic hit the travel industry hard. Can you tell us more?
That's right. On Wednesday, Finance Minister Choi Kyung-ho announced the details of the plan with a price tag of almost $50 million during an emergency economic and livelihood meeting presided over by President Yoon Suk-yeol. Private spending in the tourism and lodging industries hasn't returned to pre-pandemic levels amid inflation and high interest. The government pledged to offer 30,000 won for lodging to 1 million people and 100,000 won as a vacation bonus to 190,000 workers at SMEs or small and mid-sized enterprises. Discounts for online amusement park reservations and KTX tickets packaged with local tourism programs as well as at department stores and duty-free shops. The government will raise the monthly threshold for gift certificate usage at traditional markets and offer 17 billion won in discounts for key agricultural, livestock and fisheries products. Measures to attract 10 million foreign visitors this year will be implemented, such as expanded number of flights and a temporary exemption of the electronic travel authorization program for tourists from 22 countries, including Japan, the U.S. and Britain. For now, the number of tourists to Korea remains at 30% of pre-pandemic levels.
And President Yoon called for ways to create economic value added by revitalizing domestic consumption as well.
Well, on Wednesday's emergency economic and livelihood session, Yoon urged ministries to focus on spurring domestic consumption by bridging supply and demand for cultural and tourism products as well as small shops and regional market goods. The president noted how worsening external situations such as the protracted war in Ukraine and inflation have adversely affected the local economy since last year, emphasizing the stabilization of the public's livelihood is the most pressing matter, with rising expectations of recovery amid eased COVID-19 quarantine around the world and improved ties with Tokyo. Yun called for simplified visa programs for foreign visitors to the country and increased flights. He urged officials in central and municipal governments to put forth measures to diversify and connect cultural and tourism content and to develop traditional markets into a cultural product that attracts tourists.
Meanwhile, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency Commissioner Ji Young-mi expects the mandatory quarantine for COVID-19 patients to be completely lifted in July.
At a press briefing on Wednesday, Ji said that in May, authorities are expected to adjust the first phase rules eased in January that lifted the mask mandate for most locations, except for high-risk facilities. The government announced a new roadmap that called for a decision in early May on whether to lower the COVID-19 alert to alert from the highest emergency that has been in place since February 2020. The isolation period for patients would also be shortened from the current 7 to 5 days. By July, the country would likely be able to downgrade the infectious disease classification for COVID-19 from the current Class 2 to Class 4. The mandatory quarantine and remaining mask mandate would be scrapped altogether. The KDCA chief did not expect a complete return to pre-pandemic conditions, as the nation will have to find ways to coexist with the virus and better prepare for possibly bigger pandemic in the future.
And finally, a presidential committee on the nation's birth rate and aging society has pledged to re-examine policies aimed at tackling the chronically low birth rate. So which policies are under review?
In the year's first session presided by Yun on Tuesday, the Presidential Committee on Aging Society and Population Policy assessed that the impact of 280 trillion won in state funds used to encourage births between the year 2006 and 2021 has been relatively weak. Last year, the nation's total fertility rate, the average number of children that would be born to a woman over her lifetime, dropped to a record low of 0.78. The government plans to triple the number of households offered child care services from the current 78,000 by 2027 and expand the number of publicly run daycare centers by 500 a year. State monitoring of parental leave granted by employers will be reinforced, and also additional support will be provided for SMEs hiring substitutes. The current system covering 100% of regular wages for parents alternately taking 3 months of leave will expand. The age of children of employees that qualify for flexible working hours will be raised from the 8 to 12 years old. The government plans to extend various benefits to families with two or more children as well.
We'll leave it there for our news briefing. Thank you for those updates.
Thanks for having me.
North Korea has long been accused of grave human rights abuses, but the regime has become even more secluded from the outside world since the COVID-19 pandemic, making it all the more urgent to put a spotlight on its atrocities. To this end, the UN Human Rights Office of the High Commissioner appointed a new head to its Seoul office last October, filling a post that has been vacant for over 2 years. Under his leadership, the Seoul office this week published a report called These Wounds Do Not Heal, highlighting the enforced disappearance and abductions by the North Korean regime. To learn more about this report and to discuss the human rights situation in North Korea, KBS World Radio sat down with James Heenan, the new representative of the OHCHR's Seoul office, for a special pre-recorded interview, which we present for our in-depth today. Asking the questions was KBS World Radio producer Yun So-yang, and here is the interview.
Welcome to KBS World Radio. We're very grateful for you joining us here today.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, so it's almost been 6 months since you were appointed to the UN Human Rights Office of the High Commissioner Seoul. Can you tell us a little bit about what those 6 months were like for you?
Well, they've been very busy, very rewarding, a little tiring. I've met dozens, maybe hundreds of people working on the area of human rights, relevant to the area of human rights in the DPRK. Building alliances, government, civil society, the diplomatic corps, victims of violations. I haven't worked on Northeast Asia before. I've worked in other contexts around the world. So it's also been a steep learning curve to understand not just the situation of human rights in DPRK, but the regional context, the security context, the cultural context. I've also had the time to explore Seoul and Korea a bit, which I'm enjoying very much.
I see. So as I understand, the Seoul office was actually established in 2015 to focus on the North Korean human rights issue. But your current post as the representative had been vacant for over 2 years now, or 2 years. What was the reason behind that? And also, what were the most urgent tasks that were in front of you when you started?
Well, the office has been here for 8 years. It's a relatively new office for us. My predecessor did a great job setting up the office. The gap in leadership was purely bureaucratic. It had to do with her moving on and her visas and other bureaucratic issues of her new post, which she's moved to another place in Asia. And in the meantime, my deputy and the 13 staff we have done a great job. When I turned up here, as I said, one of the key things for me was to establish the alliances with government and with others to try to move forward on this issue, which appears to be a little stuck. People appear to be unsure about how to move forward on this chronic human rights issue, which has been there for a very long time. I've come from another situation, Israel-Palestine, which people also think is chronic and stuck. So I have a little bit of experience in dealing with this. But one of the things is to make sure you have your alliances together. And that's what I've spent quite a lot of my time coming here. I had a to-do list as soon as I arrived. We've had to put out two major reports, which I'm happy to talk about. We have to work out how to capitalize on the 10th anniversary of the UN Commission of Inquiry on North Korea to try to work out how we can use that event to move the conversation forward. Part of all of that is also to raise the profile of our office, which was high on my to-do list. And part of that is me being here today as well.
I see. So moving on to North Korea now, tell us a little bit more about what the current human rights situation in North Korea is like.
Well, I mean, where to start? It is a chronic situation. It's not new. It's not temporary. It's been there for a long time. And the violations that we see are deep. The Commission of Inquiry from 10 years ago enumerated in exhaustive detail the sorts of human rights issues we have in DPRK. I don't think any of those have disappeared. Some of them we know improved slightly after the Commission of Inquiry, things like ill treatment and torture and detention. But others have got worse. We're talking there about summary executions. We're talking about the right to health, the right to food, the right to movement, freedom of movement, the right to information, the right to freedom of belief, including religious belief and political belief. Our work is based on the information coming from what we call escapees from DPRK. Not only on that information, but that's a major part of our source of our information. Now, for the last 2 years, the closure of DPRK has meant there's very few of those escapees coming. We obviously have escapees coming. They will have left the country, DPRK, before COVID. They will have been foreign workers in other countries. Or else we have the testimony of those who arrived here after many years. Many stay in China, as we know, for many years. So my point is that we don't know exactly what's happening there at the moment. We have a good idea, but not exactly. But what we do know is there's serious issues around the right to food. There's serious issues around freedom of access to information, because the government has promulgated a law about accessing information, particularly cultural information from the Republic of Korea. And we know that the border with the People's Republic of China has been fortified, so right to movement issues have got much worse. But, I mean, I could speak for hours about it.
I see. So there are still lots of problems still very much prevalent in North Korea. But speaking of which, North Korean human rights resolutions have actually been adopted at the United Nations for nearly 20 years now. And critics would or could say that there has not been much groundbreaking improvements in the human rights situation in North Korea. I was wondering if you agree with this statement and what you think is the way to bring about effective change in North Korea.
Well, it is quite depressing. I mean, to have a chronic situation such as this, and action and attention from the international community for years, and it feels like things, if not staying the same, are actually getting worse. I guess a little bit of context, DPRK is not the only situation with that vision. Yeah, there are many human rights situations around the world which have been chronic. We also have a number of situations where, concerted action by the international community appears to have brought almost no results. So, and I can mention some specific examples. I think what we need to understand is a few things. First of all, is human rights is always a long-term project in any country. Even here in the Republic of Korea, you have a very strong human rights, sort of context or community here. You have a strong human rights base to this country, but that came after a long time, like in many countries. So we have to have a mid and long-term view. The second thing is that we know that change in terms of human rights will come requires that we know what's going on. And that's the role of our office, is to get the facts, to document them, to legally analyse them, and to make them publicly available, transparency. So it's that recording of what's going on, together with support for human rights defenders and victims, which we know will lead to change. Why do I focus so much on facts and documenting facts? We're in the world where now there's so much media, there's so many facts. We're in the world of so-called fake news. Solid, verifiable facts are more important than ever at the moment. And I think that this is the basis for change in the future. But I have to admit with you, at the moment, it is quite depressing.
Right. So you think that documentation is very much important?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Documentation is key. It's key.
So as we've discussed so far, North Korea is consistently identified as one of the world's worst human rights abusers. However, the issue of human rights in North Korea is, in a way, a very complex one, because it is intertwined with not only human rights, but also denuclearization and the issue of inter-Korean relations as well. How do you, as the head of the Seoul office, balance these two issues of human rights and the issue of nuclear security?
Well, I think my role and our role is not so much to balance them, but to bring them together, because that, in my view, has been one of the problems with dealing with DPRK. It's been siloed in the sense of it's been human rights here and it's been peace and security and non-proliferation here. And a lot of talk about the human rights situation in DPRK, but as soon as there's some crisis, some missiles launched, that talk disappears and we go into a peace and security context. Member states of the United Nations and the United Nations itself are built on a number of pillars. Peace and security is one, human rights is another, development is another. We can't just focus on one. So part of our role is to bring those two together. Now, people say to me, how can you say that? How can you say that human rights and peace and security are two sides of the same coin? In many countries, we know now that human rights violations lead to a situation that endangers either peace and security in the country, regionally, or international peace and security. Look at the situation in Syria. Yeah. So it actually provokes peace conflict issues. Or it makes them worse, as we're seeing at the moment in Ukraine. The situation in DPRK, in my view, is one of the clearest examples where violations of human rights within the country actually directly impact the possibility of conflict, because many of the violations in DPRK are linked to strengthening the military side of the state. Mm. So issues like forced labour, issues like enforced disappearance relating to, you know, experts, issues like the issue of resources available for health and education compared to the resources available for armaments. So in my view, we can draw a direct line between human rights violations and the security situation. And you can't deal with the security situation without dealing with the human rights situation.
I see. Moving on to South Korea now. South Korea's unification ministry announced that it would release on March 31st, that's just 2 days from now, its annual report on North Korean human rights to the public. Although these reports have been published every year since 2017, they remained secret due to security issues. What are your thoughts on these annual reports being released to the general public?
Well, indeed, they weren't published. That was the issue. Listen, as I said before, human rights is all about information and transparency, and I can only applaud the government for releasing this report now. It's important for many reasons. It's important for transparency, but it's also important because the Republic of Korea probably has more information than anyone else about what's going on in North Korea and DPRK. And I hope that this is shared in the report. The reports are also sharing reports. Some people say, well, there are security concerns about sharing reports. We publish a number of reports every year. Other member states publish human rights reports. Civil society publish hundreds of reports on DPRK every year. There may be some national security interests, and that's in every country has to deal with that. But I think there's certainly a margin of information that can be made public, and I look forward to reading it on Friday.
I see. So something positive.
Absolutely.
I see. The ministry also said in March that it would launch a committee of experts to advise the government on the establishment of the North Korean Human Rights Foundation. The foundation was also stipulated by the North Korean Human Rights Act that was passed in 2016, but that was 7 years ago, actually, but has not been established yet. What do you make of this move by the Unification Ministry?
Well, I mean, this is a matter for the Republic of Korea. You have law, you have legislation that mandates a number of things. As a matter of rule of law, they should be done because National Assembly, your parliament, has decreed that they be done. Some of them have been. We've had the appointment of Ambassador Lee Shin-hwa as the envoy, and we work very well with Ambassador Lee. This move consolidates that. Clearly, any political issues about the establishment of the foundation need to be sorted out by the political parties and the government. It's not for me to say.
I see. So all in all, what would you say South Korea's role is in resolving North Korea's human rights issues?
Well, first of all, South Korea is key in this story. I mean, obviously, it's the most involved state. One thing I would say is that South Korea does and should continue to join the international consensus on human rights in the DPRK. And in some ways, it should lead on that. It should I've spoken about information. It should be providing any information it can to the international community, including our office, on the human rights situation in North Korea. I realise there may be national security implications for some of that, but whatever they can provide would be useful. One of the things that our office does is to look for pathways for accountability, for holding individuals to account for human rights violations or even international crimes. And the Republic of Korea has a role in that because you have an extremely well-functioning legal system and judiciary. You have the presence in this country of a number of victims. Many, I think I can say pretty well, all of the escapees who come from North Korea are victims of some form of human rights violation. So I think that accountability needs to be looked at closely here to see whether there's a possibility to hold people to account here for violations in the North. We're not saying that South Korea has violated, we're saying it's North Korean violations. And you have experts in this country. South Korea, the Republic of Korea, has always, you know, provided fantastic judges to the International Criminal Court. So the capacity, the knowledge, and the presence of victims on the territory suggests that accountability should be moved forward here. I think South Korea has a key role to play in that regard.
Yeah. I see, especially in legal accountability, you're saying.
That's one of them, yeah, absolutely. Yes. Information, legal accountability, and international leadership. Right. Obviously, if there's issues of human rights with respect to defectors in South Korea, they should also be addressed as a sort of a, how shall I say, a leading by example.
Yeah? I see. So lastly, last but not least, what do you hope changes for North Korean human rights by the end of your term? And what kind of future do you envision for North Korea by then?
Changes by the end of my term? Well, I mean, many things are out of our hands. We're a small human rights office, relatively. But first of all, I would hope that, and being reasonable, I would hope that the most egregious forms of violation are lowered in DPRK. One of them is enforced disappearances that we put a report out on yesterday. We would hope that enforced disappearances are not only stopped, but there is some form of acknowledgement and reparation for victims. The thing with enforced disappearance is that those who are disappeared are a victim, but also their families. And we have well over 200,000 people disappeared by North Korea. If you multiply that by the number of family members, and they're all victims of the crime, we're into millions of people who are victims. There are small steps that can be made, which we will be encouraging. Just information about what happened to loved ones. A bit more ambitious would be the return of remains. I realise that might be a bit more ambitious, but why not try for that? I hope that this story of peace and security that we talked about earlier comes together so that human rights issues about DPRK regularly appear in, for example, the United Nations Security Council, that the Council talks about DPRK, not just in terms of proliferation and security, which is very important, but also in terms of human rights. I would hope that my UN colleagues get back into North Korea. They're currently outside the UN country team. It's important for the UN to be in there. And I would hope that North Korea engages more with the United Nations, particularly our expert bodies. They do to an extent, and I think that will continue, but I would really hope that that expands because we take a two-track approach. There's an accountability, a harder approach, but also an engagement approach. And we know from experience that you have to engage in order to bring change as well. The door to that has been shut for a long time, but let's see. Once the closure of the country ends, there may be opportunities to engage more in human rights.
I see. That is the end of our interview for today. Thank you so much for joining us here at KBS World Radio.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 8.98 points, or 0.37% on Wednesday, to close the day at 2,443.92. The Tekkebi Kosdaq also rose, gaining 10.43 points, or 1.25%, to close at 843.94. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 3.91 against the U.S. dollar, closing the day at 1,302.71. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's Korea Trending, our daily segment where we take a look at some of the other news headlines that have been trending online. And for that, our contributor Walter Lee joins us in the studio now. Walter, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Jang-ho. It's always good to see you.
Okay, so what topics do you have for us today?
Okay, so for today's trending topics, we have details about the Seoul Metropolitan Police's crackdown on vehicles, which is set to begin in a few days. Then we'll discuss a police investigation into a teenager in Daegu, south of Seoul, who died after hospitals refused to admit her. And finally, a nationwide recall has been launched for zucchini squash.
Okay, let's start with that first story then about a crackdown on vehicles. What sort of crackdown? Can you tell us more?
Okay, so drivers should take extra caution on the roads as unmanned cameras will capture rear license plates if you break any traffic laws. The Seoul Metropolitan Police Department announced on Wednesday that it will conduct a crackdown starting next month. These unmanned cameras for the rear of your vehicle were installed at a three-way intersection of the Sangbong Underpass in Seoul's Jungnang District. They were installed in November last year on a trial basis. Now, during the trial period, which ends this month, warning letters were issued. However, from April 1st, fines will be imposed on those who violate traffic laws.
Right, so until now, they were just warning letters. But from April 1st, fines will go out.
Right.
Currently, most traffic cameras can only capture your front license plate, right?
That's correct. So this made it difficult to penalise motorcycles that only have license plates on the back of your vehicle.
Mm.
So according to the police, there are currently three unmanned rear view traffic enforcement devices in the country. One is in downtown Seoul and one each in Suwon and Hwasong Gyeonggi province. Police said the devices were well received during the pilot program. It added that they will be installed at five more locations that are prone to traffic accidents in Seoul.
Right, so this seems to be an attempt to crack down on motorcycles as well then.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of fines are people looking at if they break traffic laws?
Okay, so for passenger vehicles, the fine for exceeding the speed limit ranges from 40,000 to 130,000 Korean won. That's approximately 31 to 100 US dollars. While traffic signal violation fines are 70,000 won. That's roughly about 54 US dollars.
And what about for two-wheeled vehicles?
Okay, so fines can reach up to 90,000 won, about 69 US dollars, while traffic signal violation fines are 50,000 won, about 38 US dollars. Now, police are going to upgrade video analysis technology to clamp down on people who do not wear safety helmets while driving two-wheeled vehicles.
Okay, so we should always be driving carefully and responsibly, of course, but it seems there'll be extra incentive to do so starting from April. Let's move on to our next story. What do you have for us?
Yeah, so a shocking story has made the rounds online today in Korea. A teenage student who was found on the street in Daegu Metropolitan City ended up dying in an ambulance because emergency rooms wouldn't admit her. The ambulance had gone from hospital to hospital in the area for 2 hours, but none would admit the emergency patient. Now, the police have launched an investigation into this case.
Okay, so tell us more about what happened exactly. Why did the student need emergency care in the first place?
Okay, so the 17-year-old female student was found collapsed in an alleyway in Daegu's Buk District on March 19th at around 2:15 p.m. She had reportedly fallen from a four-story building but was conscious. She had suffered bruises to her right ankle and to the left side of her head. Now, the emergency responders called local university hospitals in the area, but were told that she could not be admitted. Eventually, the ambulance headed to another general hospital at around 3:39 p.m., but was again told she could not be admitted as the ward was full. After many inquiries, they found one general hospital that would admit her and arrived at 4:27 p.m., however, the 17-year-old went into sudden cardiac arrest. The paramedics administered medication and performed CPR and transported her to a nearby higher-level hospital around 30 minutes later. But unfortunately, it was too late.
This really is tragic. You mentioned that the police have launched an investigation.
Yes, they have. So the police are investigating whether the hospital's negligent in their work in relation to the teenager's death. The National Forensic Service also performed an autopsy on the deceased to find the exact cause of death. The results have not been released as of yet.
It's important to note that this took place in Daegu, North Gyeongsang Province.
Mm.
And this incident seems to have shown the critical situation in regions outside of the capital area where there are simply not enough doctors, especially specialist doctors. Everyone just wants to be in the capital, it seems. So this seems to show how serious this trend is and the tragic consequences it can lead to.
Mm.
Okay, let's look to our final story. It's about a massive recall of zucchini in Korea. Can you tell us more?
Yes. So it was found that genetically modified zucchini squash that were not approved by the South Korean government have been in circulation. So the government is taking action to collect and dispose of them. Now, the Ministry of Food and Drug Safety and the Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Rural Affairs have announced that the consumers or retailers who have bought the stored domestic zucchini squash can return them for compensation at major discount chains. The return period is from Wednesday to April 2nd. Food suppliers who have purchased the squash from produce wholesalers can also return them to where they made the purchase.
Well, this sounds concerning. When was this discovery made public?
It was discovered last Sunday. So the government confirmed that some zucchini squash seeds in Korea were judged to be non-approved genetically modified living organisms, or LMOs. So since this year, the government has been conducting inspections on zucchini squash seeds that local companies have applied for registration as new varieties. Two seeds bred by a certain company which imported them from the US without going through domestic quarantine. quarantine procedures were identified as LMOs. They've been in distribution from 2015 until recently.
Okay, so do we know anything about perhaps the harmful effects of these LMOs, or if there are any?
So food safety authorities in the US and Canada have evaluated that genetically modified zucchini squash are not harmful to the human body, and the environment impact is similar to that of a regular squash. Meanwhile, please do keep in mind that returns will only be allowed until April 2nd, as zucchini squash that were not found to be LMOs in the inspection will resume shipping and sales on the 3rd.
Right, so there doesn't seem to be any reason to panic as such, but it seems these zucchini squash have fallen foul of Korea's regulations, so a recall is underway. Okay, that's where we're going to leave it for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for those stories, Walter, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
It's time now for our Wednesday segment, Korea Book Club, where we delve into the world of Korean literature. Joining me this week is literary translator Beth Eun-hee Hong, which means it's our monthly edition of the club, where we look at popular works or bestsellers that have not been translated yet from Korean. Beth, hello. It's so great to see you.
Hi, Chang-ho. Good to see you too.
Okay, so what did you bring for us this month?
This month, to match the warmer spring weather, I've brought a lighthearted book called 엄마 박완서의 부엌, 정확하고 완전한 사랑의 기억, which is written by Ho Wan-suk, published in January 2021 by Semicolon as part of its Ding series.
Okay, let's translate that title as well. So it's the translation that we have made is Mom Bagwan-seo's Kitchen, Memories of Accurate and Perfect Love. So this is actually a collection of 21 short essays by Ho Wan-suk, who is the daughter of the famed writer Park Wan-seo, whose works we have featured on Korea Book Club before as well. So tell us more. What do we know about how this work came about?
Yes, so this book came out on January 22nd, 2021, to commemorate the 10-year anniversary of Park Wan-seo's passing. And many Koreans know her as a literary titan with a career that spans several decades, starting from 1970 with Namok, The Naked Tree. And on a personal note, she's also one of my favorite Korean authors of all time, which is what made me want to choose this book. Each chapter is a recollection of a certain dish or food that the author recalls Park preparing for her. Many of her memories take place around the kitchen of a yellow Hanok-style house in Bomundong in Seoul, where they lived as a family from the early 60s to 80s. The author recalls that in this house, her mother actually spent more time in the kitchen than in her writing room preparing food for her five children.
Right. Well, when you have five children, I imagine that would be the case. But it also seems like Park Wan-seo was quite picky about her food as well, Beth.
Yes, she was, certainly. The author said in an interview once that one of the quotes that best encapsulates her mother's attitude towards food is the following. I can suppress the urge to eat something delicious, but I can never eat anything bad. So funnily enough, this kind of reminded me of that super haughty food critic in Ratatouille and impressed upon me how vital food was to her as something beyond simply a means of survival.
Yes, it sounds like she would balk at some of the meals that I make for myself sometimes then. Anyway, understand, though, that we learn that Park Wan-seo actually learned how to cook many dishes from scratch when she got married from an old cookbook called Joseon Yoribop, right?
Yeah, we can see that her life is actually reflective of very many intelligent women of her generation. Though Park Wan-seo was accepted to Seoul National University, she had to drop out due to the outbreak of the Korean War and the death of her brother. So despite having to give up her education, we see that she found joy in raising her family while also nourishing her innate creativity as she went on to publish 15 novels and 10 short story collections throughout her very prolific career.
Yes, and I suppose we cannot talk about this book without talking about the themes in Park Wan-seo's own work. What are some of the parallels?
So a lot of people know her writing style for its very down-to-earth and visceral descriptions of ordinary people's lives that illuminate a greater truth about the society at that time. So, and true to this style, descriptions of food and cooking figure prominently in her stories as well. For example, there's a famous description of winter cherries in 그 여자네 집, in which their brilliant color is described in detail. And within the story, which is actually about the tragic love between a woman and a man who are torn apart by the chaotic years leading up to the division of North and South Korea, winter cherries actually symbolize the little watchman's lantern that protects the protagonist's lover.
Yes, actually, when we zoom out to look at some of the broader themes of her work, we see that her career spans some of the most eventful decades of modern Korean history, right?
Yeah, for listeners who don't know about Park Wonsa, her work can be divided into three main themes. First, with the tragic events and fallout of the Korean War. Second, the hypocrisy and materialism of middle-class Koreans during the country's rapid industrialization, starting in the 60s. Then in the 1980s, she turned increasingly toward problems afflicting women in patriarchal society while continuing to engage with the lives of middle-class Koreans. And so through Ho Won-suk's intimate perspective of a daughter reflecting on her mother's cooking and family life, readers can gain a deeper appreciation for how Park was able to write with such clarity and self-awareness amid such chaotic times.
And indeed, it's impressive that Park was able to write so prolifically despite her extremely busy family life and amid so much social and political upheaval as well. What stood out the most for you in the descriptions of her domestic life, would you say?
So some of the most memorable and heartwarming descriptions of family life were of the father coming home on the dot at 7:30 every evening with crispy cinnamon dusted donuts or freshly fried croquettes for the family, or to their mother's mouth-watering membosha. So these are scenes that are actually hard to come by these days in fiction, as well as in real life here. As we know, Korea is increasingly a country of single-person households with a lot of ominous headlines about the demographic cliff the country is heading toward with its record low fertility rates and super-aging population.
Indeed. I understand that this collection isn't simply a sunny collection of war memories either, though. There are perhaps, should we say, some unexpected themes that come up about death and grief.
Yeah, in a touching chapter, actually, called Mandu Taryang, which I guess we could translate roughly to dumpling lament, we get an intimate glimpse of how Park Wonsa dealt with the death of her son. To give some context here, in 1988, Park went through a series of tragic personal events. Her husband died of lung cancer, and 3 months later, her youngest son, Ho Won-tae, who was a resident at Seoul National University's medical school, passed away in a car accident at the age of 25. So Park's son is described as having such a great appetite for his mother's gaesong mandu that he would eat 25 at a time to Park Wonsa's great delight and satisfaction. However, as we, you know, understandably after his death, the author notes that her mother no longer felt any joy in making these dumplings. And, you know, this makes the reader reflect on the intimate connection between food and love and how our physical appetite is linked to deeper emotional yearnings. So it was after this accident, actually, that Park moved to a small detached house in Guri in Gyeonggi province, where she continued to write and tend to various plants until her death.
Right, so it's a book that has many layers then, from the lighthearted to more deeper and emotional topics as well.
Yeah.
So what's been the reaction to this book by readers in Korea?
Well, given how beloved Park Wonsa is here, many readers have responded to this book by saying that they cooked some of the dishes featured in it, especially the gaesong mandu that we just mentioned. It's also fitting that even after her death, Park continues to touch readers' hearts through one of the most visceral routes, which is their stomachs. in addition, many praise the author Ho Won-suk's dedication to preserving her mother's legacy through this very carefully curated collection of essays.
Yes, you mentioned Ho Won-suk. It seems perhaps the presence of Park Wonsa somewhat overshadows, or at least hangs over the writer here. Can you tell us more about her as well?
Mm-hmm. She was born in Seoul in 1954 as Park Won-seo's eldest daughter. She studied Korean language education at Seoul National University and went on to work as an editor of a famed humanities magazine before becoming a full-time homemaker with the birth of her first child. And in 1992, she wrote 행복한 예술가의 초상, Portrait of a Happy Artist, which is a biography of her mother's. And after Park Won-seo passed away in 2011, Ho moved back to her mother's home in Guri and dedicated herself to anthologizing her mother's work, helping to compile the complete collections of her novels and short stories. Mm. To date, she's published 5 essay collections of her own and has been part of various essay anthologies.
Well, this seems like another work that celebrates and helps us learn more about her mother, Park Won-seo. Once again, it's called 엄마 Park Won-seo의 부엌, or as we have translated, Mum Park Won-seo's Kitchen. We are out of time, so we'll leave it there. But Beth, thank you for bringing us this book for us, and we'll catch up with you again next time. Take care.
See you next month.
And that wraps up our show today. We'll be back tomorrow with our Thursday edition of the show with our contributor Hannah coming in to talk about cherry blossom season for Explore Korea. That along with our regular news updates and analysis. So we hope you join us again for that. In the meantime, we hope you have a great day. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.